finding meaning out of the death of a brother and overcoming postnatal depression, plus becoming a queen. Hi, I'm Melanie Tate, and welcome to Now Hear This, where people are telling their true stories all over Australia into a microphone without any notes, very, very bravely. But today, we're still in Tasmania, and we're going inside a very special Now Hear This at the Moona Arts Centre. With my colleagues at 936 ABC Hobart, we asked people to share their stories to the theme, Now Hear This, the Mental Monologues. Now, the program you're about to hear includes references to suicide, and if this is triggering to you, please call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Meet Mitch McPherson.
The date was January 14, 2013. The day was a Monday. I had gone back to work for my first day back for the year after a nice, long, relaxing break with family and friends over Christmas. I was a glazier at the time. I'd served an apprenticeship and had been glazing for about 7.5 years. Life was pretty normal, and we all know what it feels like to go back to work after a long break over Christmas. It's awful. So I threw a lot of texts around and a lot of phone calls to get through a pretty morbid day, but ended up getting through it reasonably well. And I arrived home on that Monday evening at probably about 5 o'clock. I did the usual stuff, which I usually did of a night time, and snacked on some food, had a shower. And by this time it was approaching evening, and I lived with my dad at the time, and I made my way downstairs to my dungeon. My now fiance arrived, and as I said, it was approaching dinner, and we were starting to have that conversation about what we would have for dinner. I had my phone in my pocket, and it started to ring, and I pulled it out and I looked at it, and it was Mum. And being a natural 25-year-old, I had better things to do at the time than speak to poor old Mum. So I threw it on the bed and thought I'll give her a buzz back later. But unfortunately for me, well, sometimes I say fortunately, I'm fortunate that I didn't answer Mum's call. But about a minute later, I think it was, the best word I like to describe what we heard upstairs from Dad and my stepmum was pandemonium. There was yelling, screaming, running around. I swear it felt like forever that myself and my partner stood there looking at each other like, what on earth is going on upstairs, when I decided to open my bedroom door and run up to halfway up the stairs, and I looked up where Dad was at the other side, and the expression on his face said it all. But unfortunately, you know, in all the yelling and screaming, I said, you know, what's going on? And Mum had followed the call through to him and said that she'd got home and my younger brother Ty had suicided at home. Ty was one of my best mates. We did everything that brothers did growing up, playing sport together. We loved our backyard cricket, backyard footy. He was fortunate enough to have a lot of friends. He loved his sport as well. He played footy for Clarence and at the time was playing for Lauderdale down here in the south. And he always had a smile on his face. He was the life of the party, happy-go-lucky, and someone that people tell us now, we still hear really awesome stories about him. If you were around him, you automatically felt warm and happy to be in his presence, and he would really give you a lift. On this Monday during the day, he'd actually spent all day out with Dad buying his brand new tradie gear because on the Tuesday, the very next day, he was meant to start a building apprenticeship. So on the surface for Tig was his nickname, everything seemed really rosy, and we never ever thought at any stage that if he was ever having a dark or a down moment in this last couple of months where he'd just turned 18, about to start a job, about to get his licence, we never ever thought that we had to have that chat with him. Was everything okay? As a family in the past, we hadn't been affected by mental health or suicide or depression, fortunate enough to never have experienced it or anyone to really go through dark days. So to lose someone under our own roof was and still is extremely hard to deal with. And, you know, since losing Tig, we've lost Nan to cancer and we lost Pop to cancer as well. And I'm sure everyone in here knows that losing someone to natural causes is really difficult, but you know, taking it from me, and I'm sure you hear it from other people, that losing someone to suicide is a million times harder to bear. It's never anyone else's fault that somebody else takes their own life, but, you know, I feel guilty, and I know a lot of people feel guilty that we weren't there to have that conversation with him and talk to him and help him get through the issues that we didn't know he was going through. For months after losing Ty, there was a lot of people coming up to us and we're having that conversation, you know, did you see he was struggling? Did you notice he was down? And adamantly, straight away, we'd say no. You know, he'd been with Dad all day. Dad dropped him off to Mum's. He was meant to come down to our place 2 hours later for dinner, and he just never came. We think it was just a spur of the moment thing. You know, something bad went on and he didn't want to jump into that next phase of his life and go to work the next day. But now that I've gained a knowledge on mental health, prior to this, my knowledge on mental health was zero, very ignorant towards it because I wasn't affected by it. I was one of those people that was rude about it, and you know, if I'd read it in the paper or saw it on the news, I'd turn the page over or change the channel because I'd never been affected, and why would I ever be affected in the future? But now gaining a knowledge on what mental health is and what the signs are of depression, I actually think back to the last couple of months before I lost my brother, and there were actually a lot of signs there, but it's just the fact that we didn't know what they were. You know, he loved eating his dinner with us. We weren't a massive, always sit around the table having dinner together, but in the last week especially, there was a few standout nights where we'd sing out to him to come and have dinner and he didn't want to come out. He just wanted to stay in his bedroom. We live right down the end of Tranmere, which is about 4 or 5K from the shoreline, the nearest bus stop, where he'd get dropped off, and he hated walking. He'd always send us a text or a call to get a lift home every day, but in the last few days, we found ourselves driving home, looking out the window, and there's Ty with his backpack on and feet down, and you'd offer him a lift and he'd say no. The last night I saw Ty on the Sunday before he passed, I naturally every night brush my teeth and walk past his bedroom, and on this night I kicked his door open and I looked in and he was laying on his stomach playing on his phone, and I said, "Good night, Tig," as I did every night, and he was playing on his phone, didn't look at me, and it took him a few moments and he just uttered the word "night" out, and I pulled his door shut and I went to bed. And I think back now, the side of his face that I saw, how white he was. There was someone lying there, a young, fresh 18-year-old, really struggling, and someone burning on the inside to probably tell someone that he was struggling and had a real issue going on. And I think back now that if I had that knowledge on mental health and suicide, there's no way I would have just pulled his door shut and gone to bed. I would have been the big brother, and again, it's guilt, but I've learned to live with it, and I know it's not my fault, but I wish to God that I'd gone in there and sat on the edge of his bed and said, "Look, Tig, something's wrong. You know, have a cry to me, have a chat. You know, let's go talk to Dad or our stepmum. Let's give Mum a call and get it off your chest, whatever's going through your mind." A few months after, again, after losing Ty, we were going through a really difficult time, and I wanted to put a positive spin on what was a really shitty situation and still is. Came up with the idea of the first one tonight, to have a prop. With this car sticker, "Speak Up, Stay Chatty," which I'm hoping people have seen around Hobart. The reason for this wasn't to scream out to everyone with the slogan "Speak Up, Stay Chatty" that my brother had suicided, but it was to let everyone know that we were struggling and to hold your loved ones close, because you obviously never know when they could be gone and leave you. The car sticker was an idea just to put on cars and for us to see it and crack a smile, and instead of probably crying when we thought of Ty, to probably laugh and think of a funny moment. The most common question I get asked is, why shorts? Why did I pick shorts? Ty was notorious for all his days, from when he was young and even to the age of just before he turned 18, for wearing his little footy shorts with no undies on. And quite often we had a lot of scenarios where it'd be, "Ty, put your feet down off the coffee table, mate." So we saw a lot of him that we didn't want to at times. And everyone knew that, including his mates, so it was a little funny for us to have on the sticker. So I'm now fortunate enough, not to talk about myself, but I work full time and this is a registered charity now. And I'm really, really... I'm really passionate that as many people throughout Tasmania at the moment, but hopefully, you know, around Australia, start to learn what I went through and what my family went through. For the major example that I give to kids is, if that last night I saw him, if you're ever me, you do go in and ask that question if you're unsure, or if you're ever Ty, you call that person in and say, "Look, I'm struggling," and speak up, because, you know, our motto at Stay Chatty and Relationships Australia, where I now work, is, you know, nothing's so bad you can't talk about it. The less families around the world that can go through it, the better. So... thank you very much for listening to me tonight.
And thank you so much to Mitch McPherson for telling that story. You can reach Lifeline on 13 11 14. You're listening to Now Hear This, the Mental Monologues. The live event was brought to life by the team at 936 ABC Hobart, and I co-hosted the event with Helen Shield. Soon, a story of quiet triumph over postnatal depression. But first, here's Jane Ryan, or Queen Jane Ryan, as you'll come to know her.
G'day, I'm Jane Ryan. I've got a dog called Harry. I've got a job. I'm an ABC news journalist in Hobart. I've got a gorgeous partner called Matt. And I have a secret. And I've kept this secret for about 10 years. I never told anyone this secret because I thought it could ruin my career. I thought it could end relationships. And earlier this year, I found myself lying on a bed in a psych ward, wondering why the hell I continued to keep this secret. And that secret is that I have bipolar. And I thought if I had diabetes, I really would have fessed up about 10 years ago. It just wouldn't be a big deal. So it made me decide to sort of go on a journey and come out, if you like, and be open about my illness. But I wanted to explain to you a little bit how I got there. It started off late last year. I started doing shift work for the first time, and the sleep deprivation was detrimental to my health. So I slid down a slope for a little while and then fell off the edge of the cliff. And first of all, I became severely depressed. So I couldn't, all the strength went out of my arms and legs. I couldn't really walk properly. I sort of shuffled everywhere and my posture changed and it sort of started to stoop and I carried all of my weight in my lumbar. All of the muscles in my face stopped working and I looked like I'd had a stroke when I looked in the mirror. My eyebrows fell down right into my eyes and I didn't recognise myself anymore. I couldn't speak very well. I spoke very slowly and it was really difficult to engage with anyone. It lasted for about a month and for the people around me it was really difficult. Obviously I couldn't go to work, so that was a huge anxiety for me, compounded by the fact that I just couldn't see that I would ever be better again. And after about a month, the switch was flicked. And for me, I experienced this thing called mixed state episodes. So rather than going on a pure manic high where I think I'm Jesus, I have this thing where I suffer mania and depression at the same time. And it's really difficult to describe the incredible discomfort that goes along with it. You feel sort of, your body starts moving all by itself and you twitch and you tap and you rock. You start talking really loudly and you talk all the time, much to the distress of the people that you're sharing a house with, I can tell you. Your heart races and you sweat and nothing feels right or sounds right. You say things that are inappropriate all the time and at some point it stops just being mild characteristics that are a little bit weird and funny and you start to become aggressive because you're driven by this electric pace and volume, driven by this mania, but you are inordinately depressed at the same time. All you want to do is die, but it's like you've taken a bag of speed and you haven't slept for 5 days. So it's this extraordinary sort of combination of things and it's really uncomfortable. And then at some point, for me, with bipolar type 1, it trips over into psychosis. So my mum was down and she took me for a walk on the beach one day and all of a sudden all the shells on the sand looked like detached fingernails. And when I heard people cycling up from behind me, I thought it was a herd of buzzards that were swooping down to peck me to death. So you've become really frightened in your natural environment and you become disconnected from yourself and you don't trust yourself anymore. So that's how I ended up on the bed in the psych ward. And it's really scary being in hospital, especially if you still sort of consider yourself somewhat different or hold yourself separately to other people with mental illness, which I have done in the past, and I think it's because I was ashamed of it. But I was lying there on this bed and I just thought, this is a medical condition and I might be lying here a kilometre away from my work. There is no way on God's earth I could imagine telling my boss or letting any of my colleagues know what was happening to me or why I couldn't go to work. But I gradually came through this process and decided it was time to take myself back. You know, I had been ashamed of this illness for so long and I had given it so much power by not being honest about it. that I decided, well, I'm Jane, so I didn't decide to tell a couple of people about it. I made a Radio National documentary. And I went out and I met people who have bipolar. And they're my people. I found them. And they're amazing. And I'm so proud to be one of them. It's fantastic. It's been incredible to hear the different stories of people who live with this illness, and it is so different for everyone. I found it so inspiring, and I feel so empowered to be open about it, because I'm proud of the hard work that I have done to manage this illness and get it under control and live a good life in spite of it. I'm a queen.
Jane Ryan telling her story at Now Hear This, The Mental Monologues. Now, if you'd like to hear Jane's terrific documentary, get to the RN Earshot website. Quick. You're listening to Now Hear This, The Mental Monologues. Our last story is from Veronica Fole.
My third child was born premature. I'd spent a lot of my pregnancy telling people that I was further along than they thought I was, and having them go, no, actually, we don't believe you. I go, look, I have small babies, and this one's measuring 3 weeks along. We're going to have a baby soon. They said, no, you're not. No, you're not. Go home. So I went into the hospital a week later with pre-labour signs. I went, hey, look, I think I'm going to start having this baby, and I'm only 35 weeks. If we're lucky, can we do something about it? And they said, you stress too much. Go home. My baby was born 2 days later. My water broke, and there we were, having a preterm baby. When she was born healthy. She was fine. She was 5 pounds, 2 ounces, and she breastfed straight away. It was wonderful. But then we had to take her to special care. She was 2 hours old. We walked her down to special care, and we tucked her in, and then we had to leave her there. My husband took me back to the ward, he tucked me into my bed and left me there, freshly birthed with no baby. Now, those of you who have had children will know that those few hours after you have a baby, all you want to do is hold them. And there I was, with no baby in my arms. I went back down to special care a few hours later, and they'd poked her with needles, and she'd cried, and she was in a suit that wasn't mine, and she wasn't mine. She spent 2 weeks in special care, and she was healthy and she grew really well, and we had some jaundice issues, but she fed well, and because she was bigger than they thought she was going to be and fed better than they thought she was going to be, we were discharged quite early. However, when she was 5 weeks old, she started having seizures, and we didn't know what was wrong, so we jumped back onto the medical merry-go-round. We spent 5 months in and out of the paediatric unit at the Royal with test after test after test, and no one could tell me what was wrong with my baby. She twitched and she failed to thrive and she had developmental delays and she was just not right. And I spent those 5 months holding her down for blood tests and watching them do 3 lumbar punctures on her. And I spent a lot of time going, I'm coping so well. I'm coping so well, I'm here and I'm doing this and we're in hospital more than we're home and it's horrible, but I'm coping so well. And I think because I was coping so well, I actually shocked myself when I fell apart. She was about 6 months old and I remember the same hormone crash from my older two children, but with Evelyn, I just wanted to die. I just didn't want to do it anymore. It was just awful. Everything was awful. It was terrible. And I just didn't feel like I was me. I felt like I was an actor moving through my life, like I was just pretending to be here and waiting for someone to call cut and for everything to stop and for me to go back to my real life, which clearly didn't involve a sick child anymore because I was done. She was crying one day in my bed and I just remember looking at her and going, wait, hang on, what do I do with you? What do I do? And having to consciously remind myself to pick up my baby and breastfeed her as she'd been twitching and seizing and failing to grow. I started to cry one day when she was about 6 months old. Christmas was coming up and I was overwhelmed and we had no money and we'd spent so much time in the hospital and my older children were desperate for attention and we spent my oldest daughter's 6th birthday in the hospital with us. So she spent her 6th birthday without us. And I started to cry, And I cried and I cried and I cried and I couldn't stop. I sat in the garden with a cup of tea and I just couldn't stop crying. And I went, hang on, this isn't right. I'd spent so long in this grey fog with no emotions that this crying thing was really weird. I wasn't quite sure what I was meant to do with all these emotions that were suddenly appearing. And so I went and cried all over my husband, my poor long-suffering husband, who also didn't know what to do with me. But I went, hey, actually, this not feeling anything, this might be an issue. I should probably go and get this checked because I'm 6 months into this medical journey with my kid and I should probably be feeling something other than this grey fog. So I went to my doctor, and my doctor has been my doctor since I was very small. So I just went in and I sat down and I said, hey, Greg, I think I've got postnatal depression. And he said, okay. He said, what do you want to do? I said, some pills would be lovely. I said, because I can't cope anymore. And he wrote me a prescription for pills, and I got pills that afternoon. Now, I don't know how my mental health would have coped if I'd even had to wait 2 weeks between realising I was depressed as all my emotions came back in one giant tidal wave that threatened to drown me, and getting to the doctor. I think 2 weeks might have killed me, because I was drowning. And there was just so much to feel after not feeling anything that I just wanted everything to stop. And I spent a lot of time in the 3 days between realising I was depressed and seeing my GP going, depression lies. Depression lies, this is not right. This is not how you feel. This is not how you're meant to feel forever. But depression lies and this is not true. I'm one of the lucky ones. My medication helped really, really quickly. I came out of my fog, the crying eased, I stopped being so angry at my children. Now, everybody says you shouldn't cry over spilled milk, but when you're in the depths of postnatal depression and your eldest child spills the last litre of milk in the house, it's probably the end of the world and everything's ruined forever. But I got help. And it took a long time to come out the other end. Evelyn is 3 now, and she has gained weight, and she's grown, and she's thrived, and she learned to walk and talk and eat in that order. We spent a lot of time teaching that kid to eat. And she runs around, and you wouldn't know that she'd had the difficult start because she looks like a typical 3-year-old now. Now, of course, we think most of her issues came from the genetic dodgy collagen disorder that I gifted her, so sorry, kiddo, mummy loves you, you have all her issues. But she's on the up. But because of the medication and because of learning to deal with my depression, I've learnt to work through what is rational worrying and what is irrational fear. She was 3 months old when we asked if we could immunise her, and her paediatrician said, well, we don't know if she's degenerative. We don't want to stress her system out. And we went, oh, so should we just avoid the supermarket and stuff with her? And he said, well, that would probably be good. Anyway, I still get anxiety. I still feel like I have to put on my skin to come out in public and talk to people. I do a lot of in-person work at markets and things. So I actively collect myself and bring myself together now. But it took time to learn to do that, and I was lucky that I was given that time to help, because for a while there, I didn't want to. I didn't want to do it another day. Now, some days are still hard, but that's life. And part of life is knowing that some days are hard and some days are better, and that we always will live for that better day.
Veronica Foll there with our final story from Now Hear This, the Mental Monologues, held at Moona Arts Centre with 936 ABC Tasmania. Lifeline is 13 11 14 if this program has been triggering for you. Now that's all we have time for today. Thanks so much to the team at 936 ABC Tasmania, in particular Helen Shields, who co-produced and co-hosted the entire night. Sound engineer from the night was Heath Moore, with technical production by Martin Peralta. I'm Melanie Tate. Hope you have a great week and get a story or two out of it.